For KOSU News, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Within hours of the Senate passing a bill allowing anyone over 21 to carry a gun without a permit or training, it gets signed by Governor Stitt. Neva, your thoughts on this now law taking effect November 1st?
No surprise, and it clearly, when you think about it, every candidate in the Republican gubernatorial race last year signed on and supported permitless carry. So this was a bill that's time had come. The issues that came up in the last session were worked through, and in fact, even a trailer bill, a companion bill that allows for municipalities to have parks and zoos and those things added to allow for concealed carry not to take place was in the mix on this. So really there was strong support, and I think when Governor Stitt quickly signed it, what he said was this was not only strong support within the legislative chambers but also across Oklahoma. So I think I think we're seeing that borne out by the response that we're getting.
Right.
And I think the real story with this piece of legislation are the trailer bills that Neva mentioned. You know, those are bills that would allow municipalities to say we're not going to allow in parks. Primarily, the biggest lobby for that has been Tulsa and organizations in Tulsa
and Oklahoma City.
They want to keep it out of the Scissortail Park. They want to keep it out of the gathering place in Tulsa. You see the NBA showing up saying we don't want this at Thunder games or in even around the arena. They want to be able to have that an area. It's going to be really difficult to enforce that now. You know, law enforcement are going to have a difficult time enforcing who can and can't carry. I mean, can you just walk up to somebody that's carrying and say, you know, this is a restricted area? Can I see your permit? I mean, those are going to be some interactions that I think are going to be unlikely. So it's going to be difficult to police. And the reason that these organizations and these municipal government entities want these restrictions is because they know it's not safe. You know, these bills don't make us safer. And the idea that it's consistent with the Second Amendment, when the Second Amendment starts off with a well-regulated militia, you know, this takes away virtually all regulations in the state of Oklahoma. This moves us to a time where we have looser gun laws than we've ever had in our nation's history, including the Wild West. The Wild West had stricter gun laws than Oklahoma has right now.
But we also have 15 other states that have enacted very similar laws. So, I mean, this notion that the Wild West is going to kind of open up and this is going to be this huge problem, I mean, there's just nothing in any of these other states that they could point to that really reflected that as being, you know, a potential reality. So I think we'll see that come up again in future legislative sessions. But the real key issues, colleges and universities, the presidents that were so strongly weighing in on this issue, the business community and having you know, having their views heard, those issues were resolved you know, in the framework of this legislation, and I think that's why it sailed through so easily.
But we are in an epidemic of gun violence. Almost every single day we see a mass shooting in this country, and instead of tightening gun laws, you know, the Wild West, you had to check your guns either at the end of the saloon or even maybe at the edge of town as per law. And so, you know, instead of tightening gun restrictions in this country right now, in this epidemic of gun violence, here we are as the state of Oklahoma making it easier to possess and carry these firearms in public.
Again, it also brings up the question, why so fast? I mean, for example, yesterday a Senate committee or a House committee passed COLAs, a cost of living increase for our senior citizens who have worked for the state of Oklahoma. That will slowly make its way through the House, the Senate. Why is this the most important bill that has to come out of the Senate?
I think it's because it's a continuation of this whole discussion from the last session. This is not a bill that just kind of popped up and no one had any opportunity to really fully vet it, go through a long process. The give and take, the compromises, the additions, I mean, all of the concerns, I mean, making sure that the mentally ill and convicted felons, I mean, all of these current points that are in law right now didn't change. I mean, so what it was trying to bring together the most comprehensive bill that accomplished what the majority of law-abiding, you know, Second Amendment folks across Oklahoma really wanted to see become a reality.
A Senate committee does pass five bills giving more power to the governor over agencies. The measures allow the governor to hire heads of transportation, corrections, mental health and substance abuse, the health care authority, and juvenile affairs, while eliminating the governing boards and commissions. Ryan, does this give too much power to the governor?
Well, there are the two distinct bills. One of them allows for the boards and commissions to remain in place, but the individuals serving on those boards and commissions would serve at will. So, you know, they could be fired or removed at any time, which to me doesn't sound like a board at all. If your board members don't have some sort of set terms or some sort of removal for cause provision, but they can just be replaced at the whim of whoever's at the head of that board, especially if that the person at the head of that board is there at the appointment of the governor, you know, we really don't end up in a situation. I think that we're confusing the concentration and consolidation of power here with accountability and transparency. I understand where the governor wants to have more control over the way that these agencies work, and I appreciate that the governor says that he wants the buck to stop with him. But at the same time, these boards and commissions play very valuable roles, and if we make them at will, we basically take away any teeth that they have. And if we put all of this power in the governor's office, then I think that we're politicizing or potentially politicizing these very important administrative and bureaucratic positions. I think the legislature will come to regret this at some point, even if they feel like they've got a good relationship with this governor. That's not always going to be the case. And there's an important check and balance that we have with the administration of government in Oklahoma that has existed since statehood over 100 years now. And we can point, obviously, to ways that we can make it better, but to eliminate the entire system with one fell swoop, I think, is a mistake.
And Oklahoma City Democratic Senator Julia Kurt said that, you know, she was worried that because these boards, these commissions, they have these meetings, and that's where we have transparency. That's where the public gets to see what's going on. If you eliminate those, you eliminate a little bit of the transparency.
And yet in that debate, Senator Julie Daniels, who has been, prior to coming to the state Senate, she was on two state boards or commissions. And what she said was really, in the last 20 years, I mean, she really felt like that she was not making anything more accountable or transparent. If anything, she was really, those boards and commissions often muddy the water. So I think the give and take on boards and commissions is a work in progress. I think we have this difference now being very kind of clearly borne out between the Senate and the House. The Senate wanting just kind of their clean deal, get rid of the boards and commissions. The House saying we would like them. In fact, we would like the configuration to make it more controlled by the legislature. And I think they'll come up with some compromise. I think the governor's already said, look, I can live with the fact that the boards continue to be in place as long as I can hire and fire the agency director. But I do believe that we need to have something in place. He says if there's a conflict of interest or something where those members can be removed. So I think there are a lot of intricate parts to this, but the kind of the long and the short of it is it's a centerpiece point for the governor in his first year in office now that he wants to see this legislature pass. And I think it'll continue to move through the process. We may not see what the real end result's going to be till much later in this session, but I think we will see something.
Yeah. That has a long way to go. So we'll probably talk to this about
And we'll probably see some border commission remain at the end of this legislative session. I think the real question, the real compromise point is going to be over how you remove those members. Is it, you know, do you have to demonstrate a conflict of interest, or is it just this person raised a question to that board and commission that I don't like, and so they're out of there?
It's what kind of looks like. And, of course, the State Board of Education, because in 2009, this whole thing came up, and the Republicans gave the governor, Mary Fallon at the time, her ability to hire and fire all of everybody on the State Board of Education. So it didn't really affect them then, but I think that's kind of the idea that what they're going for the rest of the boards.
The other side of this is, you know, I've said the legislature may come to regret this, the governor may come to regret this, whether it's this governor or the next. You know, having all of that power comes with a lot. I mean, he says he wants the buck to stop with him. You know, maybe
but
a couple of years from now, he may not want
but
that.
But if you want true accountability and true transparency, this seems to me to be the most, the best vehicle that's been laid on the table as a possibility to make that a reality.
The Senate Health and Human Services Committee gives its stamp of approval on a bill to make abortion illegal if the U.S. Supreme Court declares Roe versus Wade unconstitutional. Neva, this bill is getting mixed reaction from anti-abortion activists.
Well, and the anti-abortion activists, the abolitionists, are never going to be satisfied with anything but a nullification bill that basically puts Oklahoma in a place where they're going to ignore federal case, ignore federal law, ignore the Supreme Court. And there is just no interest, I think, among most pro-life Republicans in the legislature to see that argument move forward. So I think there is this, there's clearly this consternation and this give and take by these outside, groups that have really, become much more energized and much more organized nationwide. That may be the case. But I think for Oklahoma, I think Senator Treat and others moved in the best way possible to make it clear where we are. We're not making in the overall picture. Oklahoma is certainly still a strong pro-life state in terms of its legislative initiatives, but this was certainly something that needed to be addressed in the way it was, I believe.
Ryan.
I think Senator Treat would have been better off if just not hearing Senator Silk's ridiculous nullification bill to begin with, which, Senator Treat, I think, pointed out, this is the kind of thing that starts civil wars. Whenever a state government says, we are not going to follow the Supremacy Clause, we're not going to follow our own state constitution that says that we have to follow the supreme law of the land, which is the federal constitution, at the point that you stop doing that, that's the kind of nullification talk that leads to civil war. I mean, that's just it. And so I think that, Senator Treat would have been better off just not hearing Senator Silk's ridiculous bill and moving down the legislative session and understanding that he's never going to win over the abortion abolitionist groups out there. Because,
well, of course, they did decide they did not hear Senate Bill 13.
Right. They did not hear it. But I think that they should have, the idea that he wanted to hear this bill that would outlaw abortion in the event that Roe v. Wade or Planned Parenthood v. Casey are overturned by the United States Supreme Court, which I think is unlikely anytime in the near future. We already have laws on the books in Oklahoma that would essentially become effective again, that, in the event that either of those were overturned, either of those cases were overturned, that would allow abortion to be outlawed in the state of Oklahoma almost entirely. I mean, those are on the books right now. This bill is really what it is. It was a political maneuver by Senator Treat to try to throw some red meat to the anti-choice groups in the state of Oklahoma, and they recognize it for the empty consolation prize that it is.
I think Senate Bill 195 wasn't throwing red meat. I think it was making very clear the position, not only of Senator Treat, Senator Smalley, and others, but to make the point that they were going to remain in control of this dialogue and this conversation, rather than have it just co-opted and hijacked by some of these groups, many of whom were from out of state. I mean, I think that's an important point. It's not just a group of Oklahomans. There were many folks coming in from out of state in this, trying to gin up this debate and conversation. And, that raises questions as to where do these folks come from? Where does the money come from to, mobilize them and have them come in? And I think those are questions that, frankly, the lawmakers have just chosen to be silent on.
Well, I mean, I saw a billboard earlier this week attacking Senator Smalley, saying that he was the reason that
in his hometown,
saying that he's the reason that abortion's legal in Oklahoma. He's keeping abortion legal in Oklahoma.
And they've said that about senators as well.
Senator Treat. And I think that what they thought that they could do was that they could shore up their pro-life bona fides by having this piece of legislation that everybody got to vote on to remind everybody, hey, that I'm pro-life. But what they did was, the pro-choice folks in Oklahoma, they were reminded, wait a second, them not hearing this bill doesn't all of a sudden mean that they're allies of us, which I don't think that they felt anyways. But if there was any idea that this was moving towards a more women-friendly legislative session, that was went out the window. But then on the other side, the idea that they could get political points from this extreme arm of the pro-life movement was, I think, Neva said, you're never going to satisfy them unless you have a pure nullification bill. So why do it at all?
And I think it goes the other way, too. It's not like all the people who are Republicans are not going to vote for Greg Treat and Jason Smalley just because they voted for this instead of Senate Bill 13. So even the anti-abortionists are still going to go. I'm still going to vote Republican. They're not going to all of a sudden turn and vote for the Democrat.
No, absolutely. I mean, these folks are pro-life, pro-life lawmakers. They came in, they ran for office on that. They're not deviating one iota from that point. And I think this sometimes just becomes a confusing sidebar conversation that folks want to get to have the process, have it go through, but then let's move on to other bigger conversations.
And they're getting a taste of their own medicine. Democrats have dealt with this for years. Democrats for years have voted for pro-life legislation, hoping that it would insulate them in their general elections against a Republican attacking them for being pro-abortion. And it just doesn't. Yeah. I mean, the most pro-life Democrat in the world is going to be attacked because they're a Democrat for being pro-abortion.
But the bottom line to remember, I think, from the legislative outlook is that strong pro-life legislation, quality bills that lawmakers look at will, I think, continue to receive a widespread support among lawmakers and be passed.
Well, those bills to me look like quality evidence-based sex education in public schools, and we haven't seen those really move this session. So,
it's deadline week for bills to get through committees, and hundreds of bills didn't make it, which means they are now mostly dead for the session. I wanted to get your feelings on any bills which faced an early demise in the session. Ryan, let's start with you.
You know, there's a lot to point to, but one in particular that was interesting, Senate Bill 574. This is a bill by Senator Allen that would have created a loyalty pledge for teachers, essentially saying that they, by becoming teachers, they had to withdraw entirely from political life. This, to me, was, of all of the attacks on teachers following the teacher walkout last year, this to me was the most strident and heavy-handed. His bill died in committee earlier this week without even a motion. I think that it got a hearing, I think it was pretty apparent from the get-go that this was just a ridiculous piece of legislation whose motives were very laid naked in front of the committee, and it didn't even get a motion to advance.
Neva.
There was a home rule bill in the Senate that, again, was one of those that I think very quickly people saw the troops being marshaled. You had the municipal league, you had the ag community, you had health care, you had oil and gas. I mean, everyone kind of make their point heard that they thought that this was a bill that needed to go nowhere and in fact did not. So even though, the Chamber 2030 proposal and other reform ideas have been out there about doing things in terms of county officer reform and county government reform that all would require constitutional change. But I think those are the kinds of bills that, pop up. Some get traction, some don't. I mean, we did see a flurry of activity certainly yesterday as the bill deadline came and went, where these committees were hustling through 30 and 40 and 50 bills to try to make deadlines. So some things never change in the process. But I do think overall, I think the takeaway is that it's been a very constructive and fairly even keel working environment out there at the legislature this year. I think Speaker McCall is kind of, after his first session, now, has kind of come into his own, leading the House. Clearly, Senator Treat on the Senate side. I think this working relationship with the governor's office seems to be very strong. And frankly, I will applaud the Democratic leaders, Emily Virgin and Kay Floyd, because it appears that rather than just this strident rhetoric, that there's been this real give and take and real interaction on a number of bills where they can say, look, you have no support among us on this, but here's a place where we can, cross the aisle and work together to keep some of these things moving forward in the conversation, not just dying. So I think it's refreshing for a lot of folks to see this process going on at the Capitol this year, given what we've seen in the recent past, and hope that this will continue to play out as we get into the real thick of it now with the appropriations and budgeting process, which is just now ginning up.
Yeah. The governor picks three corrections reform advocates to the five-person pardon and parole board. Stitt named Kelly Doyle, Adam Luck, and Robert Gilliland all of whom have experience in criminal justice. Neva, what are your thoughts on these appointments?
I think the appointments look excellent. I mean, when you look at their resumes and you look at their backgrounds, you look at their interest in really being active participants on this board, I think the governor, again, as we see him make his selections, who are going to be the individuals on his cabinet, who are going to be the people on these boards and commissions as these open up, I think we're seeing a very different look. And he's saying, look, I want to see people that have a kind of a fresh new outlook, a new set of eyes on problems that exist in these areas. And as I say, when you look at the resumes on all three of these individuals, you have to say that they really come to the table with some real expertise to infuse into the process.
Ryan, so many times we see these people who are law enforcement, mm-hmm. DAs getting yep. announced to these boards, but these aren't those kinds of people.
Absolutely not. I mean, this has the potential for a real sea change at the Pardon and Parole Board. I mean, we're looking at the Pardon and Parole Board. They've made some improvements on their backlog over the years, but they still have an incredible backlog of cases. Their recommendations that they've been making to the governor or that they're allowed to make by themselves under law, those are just a small fraction of a percentage of where they really should be. And we trail the nation in the way that we actually look at people that are up for pardon and parole. I mean, we've looked at this board for the longest time, has had a majority of individuals that have had a punitive mindset. I mean, there have been instances where board members have literally turned their back on applicants in these pardon and parole board meetings, and as a sign of defiance to their application that they would even have the audacity to show up there. There are a lot of things that we need to do to make this pardon and parole board system work better. We have inmates right now that refuse to even apply for parole because the conditions on parole, not only are they so onerous that, you know, law-abiding folks that have never been in trouble with the law at all, or I shouldn't say law-abiding folks that haven't been caught, because every one of us breaks a law every single day and we just have the benefit of not getting caught. Folks that have been caught have these onerous conditions put on top of them that they will say, you know, it's easier for me to sit in prison for another year or maybe another 2 years than it is to go out under supervised release. So we've got to change some of that. We've got to make it less expensive whenever they come out because of the fines and fees that are on top of them when they get out. But the folks that are on this board right now, for the first time maybe in recent history, if history at all, and the board's entire history, we have a majority of folks on that board that are reform-minded and recognize that a lot of the folks that we have in prisons today shouldn't be in prisons.
And even the instructions he's giving to these parole boards is he wants to see more. He wants to see more work from them, getting people out of jail, doing the hard work that it takes to get more people out on the streets and being productive members of
Absolutely.
Society.
Absolutely, and even when he proposed in his executive budget the $150,000 to have the additional pardon and parole investigators, I mean, he wants to also put in place what is needed in terms of making this a reality. And clearly, I mean, when you look at the fact that there was a 77% decrease in inmates that were granted parole release, I mean, in less than a decade, I mean, these numbers are upside down. And so, I mean, it's going to be a give and take process, just like we're going to see in some of these criminal justice reform bills that are still moving through the legislature. I mean, there's some swing there. I mean, not everyone's going to sign on to every single measure in its totality, but what we need to continue to see is the forward motion. And I think the governor leads that charge by making it very clear he wants to be a real change agent in this regard.
And a big shocking statement I saw in the Tulsa World about the fact that it's hard for people who come right out of prison to get jobs. 65-70% first years don't get jobs at all, because more than 8% of all Oklahomans have at one time been incarcerated, charged with a crime. That's a huge number.
Well, and that makes, you know, things like retroactivity of State Question 780 so important, because passed the House. Not only does that, you know, take away, possibly let folks out of prison right now for felonies that would be misdemeanors under the current law, but 60,000 plus Oklahomans would be eligible to go back to court and be resentenced as a misdemeanor, so that they no longer have that felony hanging over their head. You know, that's a huge change for those individuals and their lives and their livelihoods.
And the process to make that happen, there's a lot of things that have to be put into place to make that happen in an efficient, appropriate manner. And those are the things that I think the legislature really is going to have to key in on.
And whether it's these criminal justice reforms or the pardon and parole board, one thing that's really important, I think, from leadership, from the governor, from this board, is to remind Oklahomans that none of this is perfect. There will be mistakes. There will be individuals that get out that probably shouldn't get out. But that shouldn't doom the entire progress that we have moving forward here.
There you go. Ryan and Neva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.